I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. In 2014, Tom Wolf, who would never run for elective office, made Republican Tom Corbett a one-term Pennsylvania governor. Last fall, Wolf handily beat Republican challenger Scott Wagner, who at one point during the campaign threatened to stomp on Wolf's face with golf spikes, not exactly a winning campaign message. Governor Wolf outlined his 2019-2020 budget proposal earlier this year and has been touting his Restore PA plan to use revenue from a severance tax on gas and oil production to fund environmental cleanup projects, high-speed broadband, and improve infrastructure and transportation. He's taken to Twitter to sell an increase in the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Anything less than that, he tweeted, was a poverty wage. Governor Wolf joins us in studio to talk about his agenda, what he learned from his first term as governor, and how he sees the role that Pennsylvania will play in the 2020 presidential election. Governor Wolf, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. It's good to be back.
Nice to have you back. And to our listeners, lines open. Any questions or comments? 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You told me before going on the air, you're not running for president. You're not going to run for anything else. This is really your last job as an elected official. Do you feel in any way unshackled?
Yeah, well, I've really enjoyed this job, and I really enjoy it now that I don't have to worry about reelection. But the thing I love most about my life is my wife and I live in our home in York County, and I'm home most nights. Haven't been home a lot recently, but at home as much as I can. And that's my favorite thing to do. And I look forward to doing more and more of that after this job.
Well, you have a couple of years left. Does that mean you don't love the legislature or dealing with the legislature in Harrisburg?
Oh, no, I do. I love dealing with the legislature. I do. That's fun. And we have had our moments, but I think we have learned to work better together. I mean, the budget for this fiscal year was passed almost unanimously, and I've gotten a good initial reaction on the budget I proposed in February. So there's a new, I think, spirit of cooperation. I think we all recognize that we have very different ideas on some things, but we have chosen to focus on those areas where we can find some common ground. And I think that's something that sets us apart from a lot of American politics. There's always overlap. It's a matter of whether you choose to accentuate the differences or accentuate where you might actually have some common ground. In Harrisburg, we're now focused on where we might be able to find common ground.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. It should be said, though, that the legislature is still controlled by the Republicans, but there are these new, young, in many cases, female progressives who are now working in Harrisburg. I should add full disclosure here. One of them was a producer here on Radio Times, Elizabeth Fiedler. But has that made a difference, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think the nice thing about democracy is that the voters do get a chance to determine who their public servants are. And in the 2018 election, Pennsylvanians spoke loud and clear that they wanted to make some changes, and there have been changes. And I think that is reflected in a different makeup in the legislature and in a different outlook.
You have made $15 an hour a centerpiece of your second term. It's now at $7.25 an hour. The plan is $12 an hour by July 1st, $15 an hour by the year 2025. I'm curious, how many people in Pennsylvania work full time for minimum wage?
Right now, it's about 400,000 to 500,000. Most, ironically, of whom are adults.
They're making $7.25 an hour.
Yep, and the Independent Fiscal Office suggests there are over 1 million who would fall in the category 7.25 to 12. So there are a lot of people, and it's there's a myth out there that most of the people, if not all the people, making minimum wage are children or
teenagers.
That's also not true. Most of them are actually adults.
Adults with children,
maybe without. But just if it is an adult with children, assume that you're a two-child family. You work 2,000 hours a year at 7.25. That puts you below the poverty level.
Right.
That's a full-time job. Now, what that means is that you qualify for all kinds of public assistance. So right now the taxpayers are supporting businesses that choose to pay minimum wage and wages that are low enough to qualify their workers. It's a cross subsidy that I don't think taxpayers ought to bear. You know, we want good jobs in Pennsylvania, good family sustaining jobs, and a minimum wage that goes from 12 and then to 15. Mm-hmm. That's still pretty low.
I could see how a large company could probably absorb the cost of paying their employees more, but I'm thinking about a small kind of mom and pop store, let's say in Philadelphia. You know, they pay people maybe $10 an hour, $15 an hour. That's going to be a big bite out of their profits.
Yeah, I was an employer until 4 years ago, and one of my businesses was lumber yards. Well, when I started in the 80s, lumber yards were, full of minimum wage folks. What did Chevy Chase and the movie Caddyshack say to some kid? Well, who was sort of down and out? He said, "You can always work in a lumberyard."
Oh, forgot
and,
that line.
And I, we paid top wages, increased to the top wages, had profit sharing, Cadillac benefits, and that not only didn't keep us from making money, it actually increased our net profit because our employees, the turnover rate went way down. They served our customers better. So I actually know whereof I speak here. I was an employer.
And you're saying it's good for business.
It's good for business. So I would urge anybody who is trying to make a go of it. I mean, I cannot conceive of somebody saying, I really need this $7.25 wage to make money here, because if you're doing that, you're only making money because the taxpayers are helping your employees get the health care they need for their children. Food stamps, that's a federal program, but there are, I think, hundreds of millions of dollars in state assistance that taxpayer money we would save if employers paid in the a minimum wage that actually was livable.
We did some research on this, and apparently a living wage in Pennsylvania, of course, knowing in Philadelphia is going to be more expensive than in other parts of the state, a living wage is $24 an hour. I mean, so $15 an hour gets you partially there, but it's not a living wage.
Well, and I think what's the statistic? If you actually adjusted the original minimum wage that started, in the 30s, for inflation, you'd be well above $15 an hour.
Right.
So I don't think a lot of businesses are paying anywhere close to $12 an hour right now. They're paying well above that. But again, to take the subjectivity out of this a little bit, mm-hmm. we have all decided that we want to have a social safety net that provides certain services and are willing to pay taxpayer dollars to pay for that. If you pay below $12, we are having the folks who make $12 an hour with a family working full-time, mm-hmm. they qualify for taxpayer assistance, and I think this is a more efficient way to do it. We'll save lots of taxpayer money.
Let me just add one thing, and then we'll move on to the sales tax that you have proposed. There's a Wallet Hub study, so take that with whatever grain of salt you want, saying that Pennsylvania was the 48th worst state to be poor because of things like sales tax, excise tax, property tax, income tax, many of which are regressive. Do you think that's true or not?
No. By the way, our sales taxes are inherently regressive, and so I could see how somebody would look at that and say, but don't forget, in Pennsylvania, we exempt food, clothing, and prescription drugs, and that makes it more, I should say, less regressive than an ordinary sales tax would be. On average, our property taxes are low, but I haven't read that study, but the way the small school districts and municipalities boundaries work, it turns out that the property tax is highest in the areas least able to afford to pay it. So in that way, it can be a very regressive tax because we segregate our communities by economics and class.
Let's talk about the shale tax. And you have tried in the past to get a shale tax through the legislature. We know the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. But I think you have a different way of approaching the shale tax.
I'm not doing the same old, same old. First of all, I separated this effort from the budget. This is not part of the budget. In the past, by the way, in the past, my proposal did pass Senate 2 years ago, and it would have passed the House. Never came up for was not allowed to come up for a vote because of procedural issues. You know, they amended, just kept amending, and so people just got tired of waiting around and went home. But my count is that we had the votes in the House as well, so we actually did have it. But here I'm saying, okay, let's separate this from the budget. Let's take the severance tax, a reasonable severance tax, on top of the impact fee, because impact fee stays in place.
For gas and oil production.
Yeah. The combination of those things is right in line. It's actually less than Texas, and it's right in the middle of those states that charge. We're the only natural gas-producing state that doesn't have a severance tax, which means we all pay a severance tax as Pennsylvanians when we fill up our car tank with gasoline, or we use a plastic product. We're paying Texas's or Louisiana or Oklahoma's severance tax. They're not paying ours, and so we're paying for their roads and their bridges. Texas gets billions of dollars a year from their severance taxes, but no one is paying ours because we don't have a tax.
Right.
And I think the Independent Fiscal Office says 80% of this tax would be paid by non-Pennsylvanians, and I have targeted that. So taking that.
And you think it's $4 to $5 billion. There,
if we
right?
take, assume $300 million a year, 20 years at a discount rate of 5%, and you go out to the market, that would generate about $4 to $5 billion present value. Do it right. probably over four tranches because you can't go out all at once for that big a number. But no other state has it. They're already using their severance tax money to fund these kinds of things. Pennsylvania's not. So here we have flood mitigation needs. We have, I was at Taggart School yesterday here in Philadelphia. They have, you know, the need to remediate lead, asbestos, mold, all those things. We have almost a million Pennsylvanians without broadband. We can do a lot of really good things with that $4.5 billion, and Republicans and Democrats alike seem to like the idea. And with a severance tax, we wouldn't pay for most of it.
About a minute before our break here, but how will the, I mean, you do have to have the legislature sign off on this, right?
Yes, they have to pass it.
They have to pass it.
Right.
So, as you said, it passed one branch but not the other. How do you get this through?
I think people seem to like this idea. We have, I think, 80 moving toward 90 co-sponsors. You need 102 votes to get the majority in the House. Well, we're almost at 90 co-sponsors. I think we have a majority of the Senate as co-sponsors. So presumably if you co-sponsor the bill, you're going to vote for it. And I think what the thinking is last year there were a lot of local floods. There were a lot of people, you know, talking about we don't have access to to broadband. I can't even use my cell phone in lots of northern Pennsylvania places all around Pennsylvania, like here in Philadelphia. Can't afford to get access to the internet. So
that's where you want the money to go?
All kinds of things like that that would help constituents of people who serve in Harrisburg, and they recognize that their constituents aren't going to be happy if they say, we don't want the $4.5 billion.
And that's Restore PA.
Restore PA.
And that's Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf. We're going to take a very short break. We got a lot of people that have questions for our guest. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and our guest today on the show is Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf. And we were talking about Restore PA, his plan to use a severance tax on gas and oil production, and to use that money to fund a whole host of cleanup projects and high-speed broadband and other infrastructure and transportation projects as well. Let me read a comment, but let me first read something that Maya Van Rossum said. She's the Delaware River Keeper Network. I'm sure you know her. She says, "You will never collect enough money to make up for all the devastating harm that fracking poses on communities. A tweet from PK, making our economy dependent on a boom and bust industry will hurt Pennsylvania. No shale tax, no severance tax. It encourages fracking when we need to stop it now." And there are other comments speaking directly to that. What is your response? And I think people are saying, no, Pennsylvania, we need a Green New Deal. We need to really get off of gas and oil.
Well, we need to move toward a sustainable energy future as quickly as we can, and I support that. I want to make sure that the transition is as smooth and quick as it can be. But we do have this natural resource here, and It can mean great things for our economy, for families, for jobs. And if we do it right, it could be a good thing for the environment.
Are we doing
too.
It right, though?
Not in many cases we are, and I'm trying to make sure that we do it right. We have some challenges in different areas, but we're trying to do it right. And the other thing is I want to move to a point where what we're using the gas for is for products that go into that sustainable energy future, lightweight products. And so the Shell cracker plant, and we could do two or three more with the resources we have here. So that we're not burning this, that we're actually creating products that would make that energy future that we all want and would address the issues of climate change in an effective way, that those products are being made in Pennsylvania.
The Attorney General's Office, the Delaware County District Attorney investigating Mariner East, this is the pipeline project in Pennsylvania. There's a lot of community pushback saying we don't want this in our backyards, and there have been some problems with the pipeline. What can you as governor do?
Yeah, they're absolutely right. There have been problems, and I am we now have a bar. I'm using what authority I have, and it's currently shut down. Now, the problems really predate me. The Public Utilities Commission really runs this, or manages, oversees it, and they gave the energy transfer folks who have built Mariner East the ability to be a public utility and get eminent domain and that kind of stuff. One of the things, I've only been in politics 4 years, but I've learned it's always interesting to be able to point a finger to somebody else. That happened before I got here. But the concerns of the residents for the Mariner East pipeline are real. I'm addressing them. I think moving forward, we need to do some things to make the oversight process better, where the pipes should go, who's coordinating that. We need to have a better coordination with the federal government, FERC. In terms of this, I have proposed in this budget giving the Public Utilities Commission another four inspectors so that we have more people who can go out and actually check on these things. I think that under the current powers and authority that I have, the Department of Environmental Protection has fined Mariner East $13 million. Again, they're shut down, and we continue to hold them accountable. We've got to do this right. Yeah. And if they're not going to do it right, whoever you are in Pennsylvania with this industry and whatever corner of the industry you're in, then we don't have a place for you.
Lieutenant Governor Fetterman has been touring parts of the state, a kind of a listening tour to find out how Pennsylvanians feel about marijuana. We have medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. The question is there support for recreational marijuana, which I think is a question being asked in pretty much every state across the country. A Facebook comment from Tommy: if we can legalize recreational pot, I think it may be fitting to use some of the tax revenue to remediate the chronic plague of potholes. Do you see this as a source of revenue, and do you have a position on recreational marijuana?
Yeah, it would be a source of revenue. Now, just to Tommy's question, last year, if you'll recall, I'm going to get some credit here. I went around to different pockets of money where we had saved in Department of Transportation and other places and raised, I think, about $180 million to address the potholes.
We got a lot of potholes.
There are a lot of potholes in the state, that would be one of the things that the revenue from this could address. I'm interested in really with this listening tour, finding out what Pennsylvanians want. I think there's an altered reality, as you pointed out. The New Jersey is considering now whether to legalize recreational marijuana.
Yep. I think they have a vote on Monday scheduled.
And the New York governor has signaled that he's interested in moving this direction. So the environment has changed, and we can't put our heads in the sand here in Pennsylvania and say, okay, so I want to know what's going on. And the lieutenant governor has his own opinion on this, but he's, I think, doing a good job of just that. This is not a telling tour. This is a listening tour, and he's getting a lot of input for, against,
undecided. Are you agnostic? Agnostic? Are you agnostic?
Yes.
On recreational
marijuana? I want to see what the people of Pennsylvania want to do.
And if the people speak and they say we want it, you'll get behind it.
Yes.
All right, an email from Jeremiah. Would the governor be willing to champion Pennsylvania's entrance into the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact? There is a movement afoot to get rid of the Electoral College and to go strictly popular vote when it comes to presidential elections. That's how you got elected, through the popular vote.
Yeah.
Do you have a position on that?
Yeah, I like that idea. I think the original idea behind the Electoral College might have made some sense back in the late 17th century – or 18th century, I'm sorry, 1700s and early 19th century. But back then, senators were indirectly elected. We moved away from that in the early 20th century. So by all means, I think it's time to take a hard look at that. I would be in favor of moving to a popular vote. I would not want to do it. I think we need to make sure that we're not – this is a unilateral disarmament. Pennsylvania is the fifth largest state in the union at this point. So we got to be careful about, as a big state where we actually get some benefit from the Electoral College, want to make sure that this is something we're all doing. But personally, I would love to see us go to the – popular vote as a way of electing presidents.
I mean, Delaware has done it. They don't have as many electoral votes as Pennsylvania has. So
right.
Would be, you know, if what do we have, 20 something?
20. We have 20.
Which is, and we are a player.
Yes, we are.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf stopping by this hour of Radio Times to talk about some of his ideas, his agenda for the Commonwealth, and to take your calls and comments. He's here for about another 10 minutes. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Linda from, looks like, Downingtown to join our conversation. And Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Hi. Linda DeJulia, Downingtown. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I want to say, I had voted for Governor Wolf in the past election. I think some of the things he's doing is wonderful. Today is National Water Safety Day, and I want to know from Governor Wolf what does that mean to him in light of the Mariner 2 and the disruption of the aquifers in Berks and Chester County?
Linda, it's a good question. Thanks for calling in. Governor Wolf, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Linda, and thanks for voting for me. Am I allowed to say that?
You can.
So thank you. No, I think that's really important, and that's what I said to Marty earlier, that the Commonwealth really has to take seriously its responsibility to the environment, clean air and obviously clean water all across the Commonwealth. So we've got to do this right. And there might be some disagreement as to whether that inherently the way we extract this natural resources allows us to do this responsibly. I think it does. And I am committed to making sure that we do it right. But if we do it right and as we do it right, this can be a real good thing for Pennsylvania's economy.
We are coming up on the 40th anniversary of Three Mile Island. In fact, we're going to do a whole show about it next week. But Pennsylvania is, I think, number two when it comes to nuclear power as a state. We've got some of these old units that are cranking along here. Some have said, look, this is a carbon-free energy source. We should treat it the way we do wind farms or solar installations. Where do you stand on that?
Well, first of all, I live within the shadow of Three Mile Island in New York County. So I was there in 1979 when the Three Mile Island crisis hit.
Scary day.
It was a very scary time. The carbon footprint of nuclear power obviously is nil. But the externality that we're all concerned about is the radioactive waste. What do we do with that? So there's a problem. And I think everybody understands that as we move toward the sustainable energy future, the solar and wind and to a certain extent, lesser extent, hydro will be the dominant forces. The capital markets are already looking at solar farms as something that is superior as an investment tool than the old-fashioned fixed-site power generation plants. But we are where we are. We can't snap our fingers and say, okay, we're going to be just right immediately at that energy-efficient future. What does the transition period look like? And so one of the questions is, what are we going to do with places like Three Mile Island that have a tough time getting the return they want and with the price they need to get that return clear on the grid? And so there's a whole conversation going on in Harrisburg, and I am participating in that and working on that. And we've got to keep in mind that there is a low carbon footprint. On the other hand, there's a radioactive issue there. We also have lots of good jobs that are affect communities like Middletown and even Goldsboro across the river. Are things we've got to be careful about. So I'm participating in those conversations, and at this point we haven't come up with a final decision. But I mean, when I say we, that wasn't the royal we.
No,
we
I,
in Harrisburg.
Yes, I get
haven't,
it.
But we're working very hard on that.
Let me put something else on the table: the opioid crisis in Pennsylvania, which is just devastating communities, families, neighborhoods. Certainly here in Philadelphia. Mayor Kenney favors a safe injection site. In fact, there's progress moving forward on that. Former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell also favors a safe injection site, and he's been involved in some of the work to make this happen in Philadelphia. Where do you stand on that?
Well, first of all, I think the world of both of those folks, Mayor Kenney and
former. I have
former,
a feeling there's a but coming, but go
but
ahead.
But I don't agree with him on this. I think what we ought to do and what I'm trying to do is eliminate the demand for all kinds of things that you would, whatever you're going to inject in. We should be working on trying to convince you not to do that. And I think we're having some success. I think this year, for the first time in 3 years since I've been here, I think we haven't come with the final figures, but I'm hearing that we think that there'll be a drop in the number of opioid deaths. So we're finally turning the corner. We're not where we need to be, but we have been working on this in Harrisburg for 2 years, and I know there's more that we can do, but I want to work on trying to get people to stop doing this. And we know that there is a way to cure or get people into recovery who have substance use disorder. Let's focus on that rather than trying to say, okay, let's concede that people are going to do this.
Well, I think that's the idea behind the safe injection site is that you don't kill yourself. We're here.
I get that.
And we will try to move you into care.
Right. I want to get them into care. I want to stop anybody injecting things into themselves.
Let me ask you about the tragic massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh just a couple of months ago. You have called for requiring universal background checks, eliminating gun show loopholes, banning bump stocks. Can you get this passed?
Also, I'm against military-style weapons.
And military-style weapons. Asking that, of course, knowing what happened in New Zealand, which kind of hangs over any discussion about guns, can you get this past the legislature?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I will keep trying. For the first time in over a decade, in the last session, we actually passed gun safety legislation, bipartisan, that took guns away from domestic abusers. It was a start. I strongly support the things that you just mentioned, and I think there is support at both the federal and the state level for that. Whether we have a majority yet, I'm not sure, but I will continue to try.
Let me get, it looks like Jasmine from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Jasmine, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm calling about, I have a question about both immigration and the opioid crisis.
You know, Jasmine, I hate to, if you can just ask one, only because we only have a couple more minutes with the governor, but go ahead.
Sure. Absolutely. Pennsylvania is one of two states in the country that has immigrant family detention, where immigrant families, children, very young age, are held in the Berks County Detention Center, which is a county-run public facility. The governor, I want to know if you're going to issue an emergency removal order, which you do have the power to do because it's a county facility, and focus your energy in converting that prison into a drug treatment facility, especially creating more beds for the warm handoff program in Berks County that's been devastated by the opioid crisis.
Jasmine, I appreciate the call. Yes, go ahead, Governor.
Yeah, Jasmine, thanks for the call. I thank you for saying this is a county facility, and the county has had a contract with the feds on this. The state does have the ability to license it, and we licensed it actually before I was governor as a child facility. As you point out, they have families there, and so I revoked that license. They sued me. And so the judge issued a stay, and so we have not been able to close them down.
Would you like to, though?
Well, I agree with yes. I agree. Okay. I agree with the idea that it should be a children's facility. It should not be where we mix families, and that they should be integrated into the community. I think this points up what we really need in this country, which is the federal government to step up and do what they're supposed to do, and come up with reasonable immigration and immigration policy. That treats asylum seekers like the folks who are in the Berks County Detention Center with dignity and doesn't treat them the way they are being treated now and put together in places like the Berks County Detention Center. So I have looked at all my options. I personally, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm told that I don't have that ability in this particular case. I've done what I can do. I will continue to do that, and I agree that we should not be doing. They should not be doing what they're doing.
Jasmine, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We have less than a minute, Governor. You're a Democrat. Pennsylvania went for Donald Trump in 2016. I'm losing track of my math. Yes, 2016, of course. Looking ahead to 2020, do you know which direction Pennsylvania? And Pennsylvania is not the southeast part of the state. Pennsylvania is much more diverse than where we are here.
I think obviously Pennsylvania with its 20 electoral votes is a big state, and it made a big difference in the 2016 race because all 20 of those electoral votes went to Donald Trump, not to Hillary Clinton, even though she only lost by 45,000 votes. I think Pennsylvania will move into the Democratic column. I mean, a lot of things can happen as they did in 2016 in the election, so we don't really know at this point. But so far, all the people who have indicated they want to run for president have made Pennsylvania a key place. I've received a number of calls from presidential candidates, and I think they all understand how important the state is, and we'll see a lot of candidates in the coming months.
Well, Governor Wolf, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf. And speaking about the upcoming or ongoing presidential race, we'll be talking about media coverage after this short break. Stay with us. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. There are, by my count, 14 declared candidates who are vying to be the Democratic nominee for president, with nearly that number considering a run. They are a diverse group by any measure, determined to make Donald Trump a one-term president. This is a goldmine for political journalists with so many stories to tell and ideological differences to dissect and policy papers to discuss. On the other hand, are the horse race, the latest polls, fundraising, the gaffes du jour, and Trump's Twitter storms getting too much coverage? We asked Paul Waldman to join us. He's a weekly columnist and senior writer for The American Prospect. He also writes for the Plumline blog at The Washington Post and The Week. Paul Waldman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. How do you think the press is doing? And what do you want the press to do in covering the presidential race? It does seem, Paul, that we have a kind of embarrassment of riches when you look at all the candidates, including the president. How would you say that the press has done so far?
Well, it's been kind of a mixed bag, as it often is. Whenever there's an election or any policy issue or anything, you can always find reporters and outlets who are doing a great job. But the question is, how hard do you have to look for them? And I think that we're seeing in this in the coverage of the current race what we often see, which is that there's some great coverage out there, but most of what we see tends to kind of favor the trivial and perhaps maybe focus on things that we can raise some questions about. For instance, a lot of the coverage tends to be about more the personalities than exactly what they want to do as president. And there's a degree to which that's something worthwhile. I mean,
sure.
We see right now with Donald Trump that a lot of what happens in his presidency is a result of the kind of person that he is, and his character flaws or whatever you want to call them, that shapes a lot of what kind of president he is. So that stuff can be important. But the problem is that the press tends to focus on the wrong aspects when it's focusing on character. So, you know, for instance, someone like Elizabeth Warren, who has put out a whole raft of policy ideas that, you know, you may think they're good or you may think they're bad, but they're very detailed and complicated. And yet, a great deal of the coverage when she entered the race was about the question of whether or not she had mishandled what her parents told her about what kind of Native American ancestry she had. Now, you know, there are lots of people debating on, you know, did she do a good job with that? Did she do a bad job? Should she have taken a DNA test? But you'd be hard pressed to come up with an argument that it has some kind of relevance to what sort of a president she would be. And that's really the question.
Sure.
We're supposed to be asking is what kind of a president would any of these people be?
Well, let me pick up on that because I think Elizabeth Warren is an interesting candidate to talk about. She is clearly a policy wonk. She does her homework whether people like it or not. She's got a kind of awkward social media presence. And you compare her with someone like Beto O'Rourke with his Vanity Fair cover. He's getting a lot of attention. Some of it, I have to say, is not positive or certainly is negative, but he's young. He's attractive. He apparently jumps on tables. He was quoted as saying, "I'm just born to be in it." But he is catnip for a lot of the political press.
Yeah, and you know, some of that may have to do with some sort of romantic notions about what people like to see in a president, including reporters themselves. But, you know, in the same way, none of it tells us much about what sort of a president he might be. You know, it's all kind of a stylistic analysis of, you know, what is he like, you know, when he goes out on the road and writes these sort of Jack Kerouac kind of travelogues. What does that tell us about the sort of the kind of guy he is and, you know, the fact that he was in a punk rock band and all these things that, you know, are sort of interesting, filling out the character of the person. But, you know, I follow politics for a living, and when I try to picture Beto O'Rourke as president, I have no idea what that would be like. And, you know, maybe that's not really his fault. But that's the responsibility sure. of the press to tell us, you know, this is what it would be like if this guy was president. And so much of the, and this gets to something else, which is that so much of the campaign coverage is about what kind of a candidate the person is, as opposed to what sort of a president he or she would be. You know, is he, you know, how eloquent is he? How excited are people getting on the trail? What sort of appeal do they have to different slices of the electorate and different states as the primary process would go? And so that might tell you about this person would be a good candidate or a bad candidate. It doesn't necessarily tell you whether they'd be a good president or a bad president.
Well, what's interesting, Paul, as you're talking, Beto O'Rourke is on my TV screen here in the studio, just to underscore what you're saying. But I wonder if there aren't either cautionary lessons or actual lessons from the press covering Obama, also from covering Trump, where certainly personality, a kind of newness, freshness, that certainly was an important narrative. And I just wonder whether there's some traps there that you think the political press could fall into in this go-round.
Yeah, you know, too often reporters turn into either theater critics or amateur political consultants. You know, so that certainly happened with Obama, and it was definitely happening with Trump, where a lot of the coverage ends up being just sort of, wow, look at what sort of a spectacle this is. Isn't this interesting? And the reporters end up critiquing, you know, how well the spectacle is being carried off. And then they also end up giving them advice about, you know, who they should appeal to, and that's the kind of amateur political consultant aspect of it. And I think one of the reasons is that it's a place where they can express their opinions. You know, as a reporter, you're not allowed to say the candidate's health care plan is trash. But you can say, you know, that event you put on was a disaster and you're doing a terrible job at creating the spectacle of the campaign. So it allows reporters a lot more latitude to state their opinions, to, you know, be either more complimentary or more insulting when it comes to how the candidates are doing. It's just a kind of a broader, it gives them liberty to do a lot of things that they can't do when they're discussing policy. And it's also something they just feel comfortable with. You know, there are a lot of political reporters who may not feel like they understand all the nuances of the candidates' health care plans or tax plans. And, you know, getting that right may require talking to a bunch of experts, but they can just go to a rally or watch one on TV and feel like they are they have all the expertise necessary to give an assessment of whether it's whether it went well or not.
We talked about Elizabeth Warren. Of course, there are other female candidates, Amy Klobuchar, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, and there's some others as well. Let me ask you about the coverage of Amy Klobuchar. There were a couple of stories, basically, that she's a bitch, that she yells at her staff. I think she ate a salad with her comb. You know, we really went down that rabbit hole there in trying to understand her as a candidate. What did you make of that? And is it a different criteria? Someone wrote about all the boy bees, Bernie, Beto, Booker, Biden, Buttigieg. Is there a different coverage, you think, depending if it's a female candidate or a male candidate?
Yeah, I think women often get judged on in ways that men don't. You know, just as a for instance, anyone who follows the campaign heard all of those stories about Amy Klobuchar mistreating her staff. I would bet you that not one in 100 people in your audience have heard any stories about Bernie Sanders doing some of the same things. But those stories are around, too. Apparently, he is not the nicest boss in the world either. But we have this expectation that, you know, women are supposed to be nurturing toward everyone. And so, therefore, it's more of a story. Now, it's not completely irrelevant to the job of the presidency. If you are a bad boss, that's going to impact, you know, who will work for you and what kind of a how efficient your White House would be. So you could make a case that it's something that does have some relevance. But it's also true that women are going to get judged on those kind of things by a harsher standard than men will. I mean, Capitol Hill is full of terrible bosses, and most of them you never hear about. Most of them you never hear about. So that's definitely the case, I think, that some candidates are going to get more of those stories than others will.
I wonder, too, about tone. And we should say, I mean, we're involved in the perpetual campaign now where someone is always running for president. But I do notice with a fair amount of the coverage, and I think I'm talking more TV than anything else, that everything is a crisis. Everything is breaking news. That there's a sort of high level of either anxiety or excitement or stress related to the kind of coverage of the candidates or the issues or who said what about what. Do you see that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're in a highly competitive media environment, and, you know, especially on TV where the cable networks have to fill 24 hours a day with something, and they need to grab viewers' attention. And so, naturally, you know, every minor development is going to be greeted with, you know, the kind of thundering music and the sweeping graphics and everything to try to tell you this is really important. You need to pay attention right now. But that does, I think, after a while, sort of leave you as a news consumer kind of numb to all of it, that, you know, it all begins to sort of meld together into one big sea of breaking news alerts. And then, you know, you look back a week later, even not forget about a year later, at the things that everyone in the media treated like a crisis, and they seem so trivial that you can't even remember what they were about. You know, I think that even those of us in the media who are trying to do a good job are prey to that too, especially those of us who have to address these things every day and want to try to bring some perspective but have this sort of constant stream of news that you have to comment on and try to inform people about. You know, I know that there are things that I wrote about 2 weeks ago that I look back on and say, you know, I tried to explain why that might be important, but did it really matter? Maybe not. So that's I think the real challenge for both the people in the media and ordinary voters is trying to see what of all this is actually makes some kind of a difference into something that is worth understanding and worth taking into account when you cast a vote.
Well, here's a does it really matter question. Do you think President Trump and his tweets suck up too much energy?
Yes and no. There certainly is this genre of campaign or news reporting that is that, you know, is the president tweeted this today, and people will write entire stories about a tweet. That can be a bit much. And again, when you look back on it a week, a month, a year later, it doesn't seem like it really should matter. It doesn't seem like it really matters at all. So that's one.
I hear
issue,
the Valkyrie in the background there, Paul Wallman.
So that's,
Wagner. I'm going to go ahead.
So that's one. That's definitely a problem. But on the other hand, you know, this is the principal means by which the President of the United States communicates with the public these days. And the fact that it happens over Twitter doesn't mean that when it's problematic, it's less problematic just because it came in that form. You know, FDR did the fireside chats, and this is how Donald Trump communicates. And so, and we've seen many times he makes policy that way. His tweets end up having an effect on our international relations, on all kinds of things. So I think that it's worthwhile to look at them as an important part of how this president is governing. So even though, you know, there are times when, you know, there's a lot of stuff that comes out through Twitter that one shouldn't pay any attention to, I think when the president is making official communications, and that's what they are, you can't argue that it's necessarily not important.
I'm curious, the Democrats decided, or the DNC decided, to exclude Fox from hosting debates. And I remember in 2016, Fox hosted debates. They were substantive. But the message, at least from the DNC, is that Fox is a propaganda channel and we don't want any parts of it. What do you think about that?
Yeah,
seems kind of cowardly, but from my perspective. But go ahead.
Well, I would say that I would disagree because, you know, it's not like they're not going to get tough questions from other networks, and it's also not like the questions that they're going to get from the Fox personnel who participate in one of the debates are going to be, you know, particularly insightful, particularly challenging. You know, those debates, they tend to get the same kinds of questions from whoever is asking them. So I don't think that you know, the public is going to miss something necessarily if Fox doesn't host a debate. And I think that what we've seen, both from what's on the air on Fox and from the reporting about what happens behind the scenes, that it is essentially a partner with the Trump administration in advancing Donald Trump's agenda. And so I don't think there's really much question about that anymore. I mean, the president speaks to Sean Hannity every night. He's got Fox personnel who are working for him. His communication director used to run Fox. There are, you know, Trump administration officials who went straight from the administration back to Fox. There's no question that the network operates in the service or in partnership with this administration. And so I think it's perfectly fine for Democrats to say, you know, that's your First Amendment right, but that doesn't mean that we have to treat you as though you have some kind of right to host one of our debates. And, you know, Fox can report on it. They can talk about the debates. They can do whatever. But they don't have an inherent right to be a host for one of them. And so I think that's perfectly fine. And you know, by the same token, if there's the next time there's a contested Republican primary, if they decide that they want to shut out one or another network, you know, their reasons might be less legitimate, but, you know, I don't think the public is gonna miss something important because the debates don't take place on one network or on another network.
Well, we're out of time. Email from Beverly: the media is doing the same with Beto O'Rourke that it did with Donald Trump. Obsessive coverage. Paul Waldman, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's a weekly columnist, senior writer for the American Prospect. He also writes the Plum Line blog at the Washington Post and The Week. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, and assistance this week from Susan Greenbaum. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.